What have you been doing all these months?
We've certainly had our adventures. Perhaps not as harrowing as our own. Drake shared a few, starting with a skirmish with whom Death Cultists Dreadnought's first week out of port. On another occasion, the Admiral sent a missile frigate to buy supplies from a mining colony, while the rest of the fleet waited cloaked a few 100,000 miles away. Some bold pirates put together a small fleet and tried to charge in under the frigate's missile batteries and seize her as a prize. Were they ever surprised when Dreadnought dropped her cloaks and showed her main guns? "We hung a few pirates that day," Drake said. "And the ones who got away will be a little more wary in the future." He spent a few more minutes chatting with his old crew, then rose. "Well, I'm afraid I must be going. Cap, tell Lieutenant Manx that I'll be back on board Dreadnought in 1 hour. I want all pre-flight checks completed and the fleet ready to go by my return."
"Aye, Captain. Admiral. Sorry, sir."
The Admiral only smiled at this. There were disappointed comments all around as he made his final farewells. More than a few must be thinking how nice it would be to have Drake back in the captain's chair. Tolvern might have felt slighted by this, but she shared the sentiment.
"Captain," Drake said, "will you accompany me to the science lab? I need to talk with Brockett before I go."
Chapter 9. Science Officer Brockett was studying feathers under a microscope when they arrived, and didn't look up even after Tolvern repeatedly cleared her throat.
"Brockett," she said sternly.
"Oh, sorry, Captain. I'm just..."
"Admiral Drake! My apologies, sir."
Tolvern gestured at the feathers.
"Anything new?"
"I'm taking a break from studying the apex substance Carvalho took from the hull. Studying the data, that is. I don't have the substance itself anymore."
Drake frowned, so Tolvern explained what Carvalho had discovered while he was out on the hull trying to free Blackbeard from the battle station's tether. She wouldn't risk keeping it on board and had ordered Brockett to incinerate it.
"It's a shame we don't have it for further study," Drake said.
"They weren't flinging space snot at us for giggles," Tolvern said. "I've got to assume it's something very bad."
"Such as?"
"What if it turned into a corrosive acid and burned straight through the hull?"
"A containment field?" Drake said.
"I was in no position to mess around, fighting off boarders, battling the mutiny on Lee's station, preparing for battle with the buzzards."
"Understood," Drake said. "You made a judgment call. One I probably would have made as well."
He glanced at the science officer.
"You've had a chance to study the substance. Any theories on its purpose?"
"Yes, sir. I broke down 3 samples, and it's odd. The composition was changing from one test to the next. In the first one, it had incorporated molecules of our Tyrillium armor. In the second and third, it seemed to be consuming part of the glass slides I'd put it on. This in spite of treating them with dyes and other chemicals. The snot wasn't inert, is what I'm saying."
"So it was an acid?" Tolvern asked, surprised that it could be something so simple.
"Just dissolving whatever it touched?"
"Not dissolving, sir. Incorporating. Turning into that substance, maybe. Like camouflage. If Carvalho had stumbled on it a few days later, we might not have detected it at all."
Brockett hesitated, and Tolvern sensed he was stepping onto shakier ground with his guessing.
"What if the substance is designed to send a signal to the enemy, allow them to track our ships wherever they go?"
Tolvern remembered something.
"Swift had been in a fight with Apex already. What if she took some space snot, and that's how the aliens found us?"
"We'll implement a new protocol," Drake said. "Immediately after any contact with the enemy, the crew will scour the surface of affected ships."
"And what about those of us who've already been in battle?" Tolvern asked. "Maybe half the fleet is already infected."
"If you'll give me the resources, I can design a coherent scanning interferometer to scan the hulls," Brockett said.
"I have no idea what that means," Drake said.
"But if it will detect this alien substance, then go right ahead."
"The science is straightforward enough, but I could use Smythe's engineering skills to make the instrument. If you can spare him, Captain."
"For this?" Tolvern said.
"Of course."
Her mind drifted to something else that had been bugging her.
"What do you two think about the strange dance with all of the lances and spears?"
She summarized what she'd come to believe. There seemed to be 2 competing factions in the Apex fleet. Her evidence was the lack of coordination, at least in the initial stages of the fight, followed by all of the posturing, the bobbing and weaving. It had grown so confused that a collision destroyed one ship and led to another being swallowed by a harvester ship. The harvester spit out a new command vessel to replace it, and that was the point where the fighting stopped.
"What's got me confused is why they didn't fight it out," she said. "If there were two different factions, I don't understand how they resolved their differences."
"That's the definition of alien behavior," Drake said. "If it mapped directly onto the human experience, they wouldn't really be aliens, would they?"
"What does that say about the room? We can understand their motives easily enough, but they're aliens."
"Are they?" he said. "You've got one serving as your pilot. I just cut a deal with the Hrum General, one where both sides clearly understood all the terms."
"You are redefining what it means to be an alien," Tolvern said.
"Perhaps I am. 1,000 years ago, our ancestors would have called the Singaporeans' ancestors aliens. Now they're just another flavor of human. Different, but not inscrutable. Why not extend the same privilege to the Hrum? If we're going to live side by side as civilizations, it seems to be a necessity, wouldn't you agree?"
"Excuse me," Brockett said, "but if you mean that alien behavior is unintelligible, then Apex aren't aliens either."
The other two looked at him, and Brockett continued.
"Apex behavior has counterparts in the animal kingdom. Not a mirror of any one species, but with elements of several. Once you piece that together, you can figure out what's going on."
"Go on," Drake said.
"Start with ritual combat, which is common in the animal kingdom, even in early human tribes, who displayed more chest-thumping and spear-waving than actual violence. When two small tribes get together, an actual fight that leaves 10 or 20 dead on each side can devastate both. Packs of lions and wolves do the same thing, more roaring and posturing than killing."
"It looked like posturing, all right," Tolvern agreed. "Like flocks of birds going back and forth, trying to intimidate each other."
"We already know that Apex has castes," Brockett continued. "There are the commander types and the more numerous drone types in all their variations. They've genetically engineered themselves, but I'll bet the castes represent an ancestral condition. Roughly speaking, you have queens and you have sterile workers."
"Like bees or ants," Tolvern said. "Is that what you mean?"
"Exactly. Social insects, but played out in flocks of birds instead of invertebrates. Why not? Some birds have colonies, and it's something that could have developed in bird life as easily as among insects. And as predators, birds have an advantage over other animals. They're swifter and more mobile. Only gravity limits them, and in a low-gravity, high-oxygen environment, you'd expect the top predator, the apex predator, to be a bird. In this case, flocks of birds."
"I'm confused about the ritual warfare part," Drake said. "Human tribes that engaged in that sort of nonsense lost out over the long run to larger and better organized societies. Tribes lost to chiefdoms, which were overwhelmed by city-states backed by agriculture, and so on up to multi-world kingdoms and empires. How can Apex compete on a colony or tribal level?"
"Think of the birds more like horse raiders from the steppes," Brockett said. "Nomads have frequently overrun settled societies in the past." "But the buzzards aren't true nomads," Tolvern said. "They've got a technological society, which means they have resources to guard, some sort of homeworld or system."
Brockett looked uncertain.
"You might be right." "If there is a homeworld, we'll find it and burn it," Drake said grimly. Then fresh doubt showed on his face.
"Back to the ritual posturing. This was the battlefield. Why would they risk it here and now? They might have won otherwise."
"They might not have had a choice," Brockett said. "Think about social insects and swarming behavior."
"You mean there's a rival queen in the flock?" Tolvern asked.
The science officer pointed to the array of feathers he'd laid out for study under the microscope. Some were drab, others had color at the tips only, and others were brilliant scarlet, turquoise, or emerald green, like macaw feathers, only larger.
"This is a drone feather," Brockett said, pointing to the smallest, drabbest feather. Then he pointed to the largest, most brilliantly colored feather. "This belongs to a queen. What are all the rest of these? Subcastes, I assume, but it seems that some of them are in transition. So maybe they don't have full control of the process," he continued. "Periodically,
Some sort of struggle within the flock splits off part of a force as a rival queen arises. That may have happened during an inopportune moment in the fight.
Inopportune from the buzzard's perspective, Tolvern said. Not from ours. It was one of the few opportune things to happen to us lately.
That would explain why there's no single armada of harvester ships, Drake said. I'd assumed they were like the battleships of the fleet, with a grisly Temple Slaughterhouse element to them. But maybe each harvester belongs to a different flock, a rival of all the others. Maybe we'll never have to face them all.
That sounded like wishful thinking. There was a whole lot of speculation going on in this conversation, and they obviously didn't have all the answers yet. Tolvern wasn't sure that was even possible. There might not be an ultimate answer.
One other theory, Rocket said. What if the harvesting changes the chemical composition of the flock? Once they start killing, some combination of status and resource availability forces change. The flock grows, and then a split happens organically.
Seems like something you'd want to control if you were the buzzards, Tolvern said. And you were perpetually locked in life and death struggles with alien races.
Drake nodded. Hence the genetic manipulation.
But you can only break so far from biology, Rocket said. The size of the human brain is partially limited by the width of a woman's pelvis. The spinal column is a clear evolutionary hack in all vertebrate species, and worse in humans thanks to recent bipedalism. The upright position has cursed us with all manner of back pain. The Hroom underwent a similar change in posture in their evolutionary history. But a little bit of luck in skeletal structure, and they face no such issues. My point is that whatever social structure evolved within the apex flocks is now baked in, no matter how much they manipulate their genes.
They had veered off topic, and as fascinating as the subject was, it was almost time for Tolvern and Drake to go their separate ways. She had one final question.
Any guesses why Magat and Dijkstra might have thrown in their lot with the aliens?
He shook his head.
I can't believe they would do such a thing.
Some biological reason? Anything at all? Tolvern pressed.
When is the last time a deer cooperated with a wolf? Brockett asked. There must be some other explanation for what we saw or thought we saw.
It was similar to Lee's position, and Tolvern was inclined to believe him and write off the two fugitives once and for all. Forget this whole mission to Samburondon. Tolvern and Drake left the science lab, stopping once they were alone in the corridor.
I might be wrong about Magat and Dijkstra, Drake said, but I'm still sending you to Samburondon.
I understand. I don't like leaving, but I don't like flying Blackbeard when she's all beat up either. Get her back in fighting trim and I'll feel a whole lot better. May as well hunt down these two idiots while I'm at it.
And it gets the General back into Hroom territory to recruit his fleet.
Drake hesitated.
It's not that I wouldn't rather have you with me.
I know that, sir.
Listen, Jess, Drake said. There's something I've been thinking about.
Tolvern caught her breath. The last time he'd used her Christian name, they'd been standing together after Malthorn's execution for treason. Something had passed between the two friends, admission from Drake that he knew of Tolvern's romantic interest, and shockingly that he was not entirely disinterested himself. He'd done so with his typical Drake reserve, which left her in greater turmoil than ever.
I'm wondering if you've been thinking about the same thing, he said.
That is difficult to say, she said cautiously. Her mouth was dry. It depends on exactly what you mean, James.
She liked the way his name tasted as it left her lips. Drake opened his mouth to say something, then took a step back when one of the crew rounded the corner, walking toward them. Tolvern realized just how close he'd been standing to her, close enough to lean in and kiss as a matter of fact. She cursed silently as she saw that it was Lieutenant Cap. No doubt the other woman had seen the Admiral step back, and there would be teasing down the line of the kind that only Cap could get away with. More importantly, the moment with Drake was gone.
There you are, Admiral, Cap said. I've been trying to get through. Manx just called from Dreadnought. All systems are checked out and your fleet is ready to go.
Chapter 10 HMS Blackbeard limped away from the battle station a few hours later. Tolvern was embarrassed by the condition of her ship, and glad that Drake had already shipped out with the bulk of his fleet, so he wouldn't see her struggling to integrate the new plasma engine while keeping the old one from breaking down. She reminded herself that they'd only arrived at the battle station 10 days earlier, and during that time they'd been forced into combat against the enemy, leaving them more battered than ever. The crews of Blackbeard and Sentinel 3 had worked around the clock since the battle, using supplies hauled over from the fleet, so the ship was in much better condition than it had been. They'd repaired life support systems and replenished their depleted stores of mines, torpedoes, and missiles, as well as patched up significant damage to the hull. 2 major problems remained. First, shields were at roughly 40% strength from bow to stern. They had to avoid any fights. Second, the blasted plasma engines, one damaged, the other rebuilt, undersized, and prone to overheating. By now, Dreadnought and Drake's other ships were accelerating toward one of the jump points. They had new charts from Commander Lee, not exactly fresh, admittedly, but light years better than anything they'd worked with before, and were going to approach the planet of Singapore through the back door. That meant a few extra jumps rather than a direct route. Tolvern headed in the opposite direction, and General Mos Driz followed with his 6 sloops. The Hroom did a few maneuvers, tested their systems, then fell in at a crawling pace while Tolvern struggled with her engines. 6 hours after departing the battle station, she was still creeping along at 15,000 miles per hour, and was ready to turn around and slink back for more tests and repairs. And then, engineering figured out an alignment issue with the newer, smaller engine, and unclogged one of the electron beam neutralizers on the second. A little more tinkering, this time with the negative grid on the larger engine, and they were off.
"Acceleration is still slow, Captain," Smythe said, "but we'll be able to reach jump speed."
"And the warp point engine?" Tolvern asked.
"It passed all the tests. It should work."
And if not, they'd disappear into the void as a stream of subatomic particles, never to be seen again. Theoretically, they might pop up on the other side of the universe, but most likely they'd simply be dead. But that didn't happen, and a few days later they found themselves recovering from a jump, with the Hroom sloops already pulling back into formation. The Singaporeans called this the Kunlun system, after a volcano on the homeworld. The exit jump point was close to a red dwarf, and things would get warm. Tolvern figured the risk of ambush was greater than the risk of giving away their position, and had Smythe blast the system with active sensors during the first day of travel to make sure that they wouldn't stumble into a flock of lances. The system appeared empty, desolate even. From Kunlun, they jumped into the Getsa system without incident. This system was inhabited, and the resident Hroom immediately spotted them. 3 sloops of war pulled out of orbit from around one of the inner worlds, and were joined by a collection of smaller craft, coming out to challenge Blackbeard and the general sloops. General Mos Driz called over.
"They are cultists."
"You mean the God of Death?"
"Yes, Captain Tolvern. They worship and adore Liam Kaa, and have sworn to fight all humans and any Hroom who would fight by their side."
"King's balls," Cap grumbled. "You'd think them cultists would have lost their religion when we smashed up their death fleet."
"It's religion, Cap," Tolvern said. "You wouldn't expect people to change their beliefs based on the results of one battle, would you?"
"Don't see why not. That god of theirs didn't help them none, did he?"
The general hummed deep in his throat.
"Do not doubt the existence of our god, Lieutenant Cap. He certainly exists."
Cap looked ready to say something else, but Tolvern glared her into silence.
"We certainly have the firepower to defeat these cultists," Mos Driz continued. "But I would rather have their sloops in my fleet than as my enemies."
"And how do you propose to persuade them if they've sworn to kill us all?" Tolvern asked.
"They might not have identified your ship as of yet. What if you were to veer off and let me speak to them alone? You could wait for me at the jump point."
"How long?"
The general turned and spoke in his hooting language to someone off-screen.
"My pilot says we will only lose 10 hours if we go meet these cultists."
But Nib Pym had apparently run his own calculations on the nav computer and spoke to Tolvern through her comlink.
"My estimate is 13 hours of waiting for the general at the jump point, plus whatever time he spends negotiating."
"Hold on one moment, General."
She cut audio to address her pilot.
"Can we delay and still catch the fugitives before they reach Samburundone?"
"I am running calculations now."
A minute later, Nib Pim came back with the answer.
I estimate even odds. If we don't, we'll arrive shortly thereafter.
Tolvern made her decision and connected with the general. Go ahead, recruit them if you can, but don't mix it up if they balk.
Mix it up?
Don't do any fighting, negotiations only.
Mos Driz merely fixed her with a look, then cut the line. She hoped that was agreement.
Blackbeard and the general's sloops soon went their separate ways. Tolvern's destination was a jump point in a similar orbit to that of the inhabited planet, but the planet and jump point were on opposite sides of the sun, which took Blackbeard far from the hostile sloops. It was close enough, however, for Mos Driz to rendezvous when he was done negotiating with the cultists. 18 hours later, Tolvern came onto the bridge intending to give the order to decelerate as they approached the jump point, since they weren't going through yet. The others were staring at a small ship on the viewscreen.
Is that our target?
Cap flashed a triumphant smile.
Aye, Captain, we caught them bastards.
So soon, I didn't expect it.
Nib Pim hummed.
They must have poor charts. If they were forced to wander the system looking for the jump point, that would explain their delay in jumping to safety.
And a two-man crew, Tolvern said. Sleep must be hard to come by. Are we going to catch them in time?
They're 9 hours from the jump, Smythe said from the tech console. We are 13 hours out ourselves.
So we can almost grab them before they make it through, Tolvern said. But not quite.
It ain't as bad as that, Cap said. The gunnery says we can fire in 5 hours, shove a couple of missiles up their ass, and they'll never make the jump.
A couple of long-range missiles wouldn't do much from this distance against a real enemy. Plenty of time for countermeasures, and a missile with that kind of range was almost all engine, with very little explosive power. But for such a tiny ship, it was overkill.
Tempting, Tolvern said, but our orders are to take them prisoner, not kill them.
So we follow them through, Cap said. Grab them on the other side.
How is the general getting on?
Still negotiating, apparently, Smythe said. The two sides have been standing off a pace from each other for 6 or 7 hours now. Want me to send a subspace?
Too risky, she said. Apex might be listening.
And now she had contradictory orders. Drake had told her to stick with the general until Samborondon. He'd also told her to capture Dijkstra and Megard. She could wait for Mos Driz at the rendezvous point and let the fugitives through, figuring she could catch them later. But by now her target probably knew she was chasing. The fugitives might break for a different jump point and escape, and then she'd never see them again.
Say we jump 4 hours after they do, Tolvern said. Forget the concussion, time to restart and all of that. Once they're through, and we're through, how long until we make up that four-hour head start?
Nib Pim returned an answer a moment later. It would take another 10 hours of chase time on the other side of the jump point.
10 hours out, 10 hours back, Tolvern said. Add the 13 hours it will take to reach the jump point in the first place.
That will make us late to our rendezvous, Smythe said.
But maybe not so late that the general would think we'd left him behind. Pilot, show the chart of whatever is on the other side of that jump.
Nib Pim put it on the main viewscreen. It was another room system, which added a complication. She'd rather have the general around to help pick her way through. But worse, there were several jump points, and two were close by. If she waited for the general to arrive before jumping, she'd never grab the fugitives in time. They'd vanish through one of the jump points, and it would be a coin toss which one. She called down to engineering and explained the situation to Barker.
Any chance we can disable their ship with a missile before they jump?
A chance? Sure, and you can also wing a sparrow with a moose rifle, Barker said. That just takes a really, really lucky shot. Most likely you're on your hands and knees looking for scorched feathers.
Thanks, that's all I need to know. Stand down your missile crew, I won't risk it.
Tolvern thought about it for a few minutes before making her decision. Once she decided, though, she was certain it was the right call.
Keep engines at full, she ordered. We are chasing them through the jump point.
Tolvern woke up on the floor, having apparently unfastened her restraints after the jump. Probably trying to find the bathroom, she thought, her stomach heaving. Heroic effort kept it down. Her head felt like one of Barker's people had taken up residence inside her skull, armed with a percussion hammer. It was her worst jump concussion in months, and as she staggered to her feet, she saw that she was not alone. Smythe and Lomelie slumped over their consoles,
Cap sat with her head hanging back, and Nib Pim whistled in pain. A young man named Grosbeck had come up from engineering to discuss another tweak to the plasma engines, and lay unconscious in one of the jump seats. Tolvern's hands worked over the console, trying to manipulate the viewscreen to run a quick scan of the system. First thing to do was find out if there were more Hroom sloops in the neighborhood. But her fingers were fat and sluggish, and her eyes couldn't focus well enough to see the touchscreen. Lomeli lifted her head with a groan and started to work. Smythe followed, and one by one, the hard-hit men and women on the bridge came around. Cap was second to last to respond, awakening with a curse.
"Blast it, how much did I drink last night?"
she slurred. She leaned over and puked at her feet. When she looked up, she seemed to recognize where she was.
"Sorry, Captain."
"Get to work, Lieutenant," Tolvern said, still trying to get her fingers to cooperate. "Smythe, I need a scan. Pilot, find that ship and plot a course. Grosbeck, get your butt down to engineering where you belong." They were all responding with varying degrees of alertness, except for Nib Pim. The pilot was still whistling, and now made a series of incoherent squeaks. The Hroom looked around him, but his eyes didn't focus. Damn it, he's got the trips. A more severe form of jump concussion, the trips could leave a man, or Hroom, with a permanently scrambled brain. Tolvern's already heaving stomach clenched with worry. "Grosbeck," she said, "scratch that. Take Nib Pim to the sick bay, quickly now." The man steadied himself and made his way to the pilot's chair. Cap got up to help. When they reached him, his eyes swiveled back and forth, and he held up a long bony hand.
"No, I am recovering. Leave me be."
Tolvern breathed a sigh of relief. What a blow it would have been to lose him. Cap also had a nav chip, and in addition to being the first mate, could serve as subpilot in a pinch, a role she'd played under Drake. Cap was no slouch, but Tolvern needed her best pilot threading their way through these hostile and semi-hostile systems, and that was Nib Pim.
"Why did that hit us so hard?" Cap asked. "Smythe, anything funny about that jump?"
He wasn't answering, and Lomeli was at the defense grid computer instead of the tech console. But Smythe did seem to be working, albeit with his eyes scrunched nearly shut.
"Smythe," Cap said, "wake up, you."
I got the fugitives," he said at last.
Then he too turned and puked his guts on the floor.
"Well, bring it up," Tolvern said impatiently, "and someone call maintenance to clean up this mess."
The small frigate appeared on the screen. It was a classic smuggler ship, the kind run by Dutch or Ladino pilots carrying high-value goods. Lots of engines and not much storage space. Small enough to evade long-range scans, and agile enough to dart among asteroid fields and land in isolated craters when hiding from Royal Navy warships. Most likely, the interior smelled like a candy shop. Sugar was the preferred cargo for those willing to penetrate so deep into the Hroom Empire.
"Does she come up in the database?"
Tolvern asked.
"Still looking," Smythe said. "Got to...
He rubbed his temples.
"To analyze the engine and do a detailed scan of the hull with active sensors."
They got the ship moving. Doc called a few minutes later. 14 crew in the sick bay with the trips. Hardest hit was engineering, where Barker himself went down. It was not what the captain wanted to hear. Smythe wasn't able to answer Tolvern's question about the database for some time, and when he finally recovered enough to do his job, another hour passed before they had enough data to make an identification.
"Yep, we found her," Smythe said. "Sort of. The engine signature matches a tramp frigate named Morpho, a Ladino vessel out of Peruano."
"Peruano?" Tolvern said. "She's a long way from home. What do you mean by sort of?"
"Morpho was 92 feet long," Smythe said. "This is only 67 feet.
Ships don't generally shrink 25 feet.
Morpho was last logged in the database 7 years ago. One of our destroyers stopped her in the Fantalus system and fined the captain £235 for carrying bad tax stamps."
"That's a stiff fine," Tolvern said.
3 times the starting salary for an enlisted man in the Royal Navy, as a matter of fact.
"Must have been a repeat offense. The next time he was caught, he'd have faced imprisonment. He wasn't named Dijkstra, was he?"
"No," Smythe said. "Some Albionish fellow."
"In that case, he's lucky he got off with a fine."
"What do you bet the bloke sold Morpho and started over with a new ship?" Cap said.
New name, new crew to keep him from getting hung the next time around. Or maybe Morpho fell to pirates, Tolvern said. Or got shot up so badly that he sold it for scrap. Either way, same engine, different ship. She considered. The name Morpho is good enough for now. Cap, hail them, and demand a surrender.
There was no answer to repeated attempts. Blackbeard kept after her, and within an hour or two their quarry would fall within range of the deck guns. At that point it would be easy enough to knock her round a bit, harpoon her, and haul her in.
Captain, Smythe said, his tone a warning. We just completed our initial scan of the system. There's trouble.
We jumped through 2 hours ago, Tolvern said sharply. Why the devil are you just getting around to scanning?
I don't know. I forgot.
Damn it, Smythe.
Tolvern was angry, but not with Smythe, with herself. It had been obvious that his mind had been firing with less than a full battery of cannon since the jump. Nobody had followed the list of protocols post-jump, starting with the captain herself, who should have straightened her crew out when they were obviously listing. That her head had been pounding and she'd nearly joined the pukers was beside the point. Smythe shared his data. Blackbeard and her quarry were in the Earless system, which was also home space. There was a habitable planet in the so-called Goldilocks zone, a damp, sweltering world that resembled Hot Barca, in that only the highlands and polar regions could have taken human settlement. Plenty of room, though, even if the largest cities had fallen into decay. All of these details were sketchy in the database, as the system was far from Albion space. A fleet orbited the planet of Earless itself. At first glance, Tolvern thought she was looking at a massive force of Hrum, an assembled collection of sloops. There were roughly 20 smaller ships and a single large one.
You'd better not tell me this came from the active sensors, she said.
No, Captain, Smythe said. We're just listening, not shouting out. But they're in orbit, so it was easy enough to find them.
Tolvern breathed a sigh of relief. That would have been a blunder, letting a potential enemy know they were in the system. All the same, she was itching to find out who they were looking at, to either confirm or deny her fears.
Keep quiet, and stay cloaked until we know what we're looking at.
This is close to where the General saw the bazards, ain't it? Cap said. Bet it's a bloody harvester ship and some lancers.
If there is a harvester ship,
Nib Pym said,
it means they are slaughtering thousands of people.
I'll wager you're right, Tolvern admitted. The both of you. But this is not our fight, not yet. We get Morpho, and we get the hell out of here.
She turned toward her tech officers.
Lemelie, get Barker, whoever is in charge down there, and figure out if we can still use our deck gun without dropping the cloaks.
Meanwhile, she hailed the fugitives again, this time offering an open channel. She had little hope of a response, but to her surprise, there was an answer. They were at the outer limits of short-range communication, and the image jerked back and forth on the screen, sometimes dissolving into blurry pixels before returning to focus. Dijkstra and Megat appeared. The tall, thin Dutchman with his hollow face and the muscular, scowling Singaporean made a strange pair. Even through the terrible image, Tolvern could see that Dijkstra looked ill. He was pale, and sweat trickled down his temples. Looked like he had a case of the trips, if not something more serious.
"You've come a long way for one little ship," Megat said.
"I am curious," Tolvern said. "Curious as to how you escaped, how you got your hands on a ship, but mostly why you hatched this scheme. What were you hoping to accomplish?"
I was hoping not to be locked up in your detention block, obviously.
We repatriated most of the mutineers, you know. I would have handed you over to Lee with the rest of them. I bet he would have freed you, too.
I have no desire to serve under that coward again.
Whatever you are doing, it makes no sense.
Not to your tiny brain, I'm sure it doesn't.
Tolvern tried the sick man.
Dijkstra, what made you think an alliance with this idiot was a good idea? You're lucky you're not dead.
Dijkstra's mouth twitched. His face looked like plastic.
Yes, very lucky. Very lucky indeed.
A strange response. Bizarre, even. Tolvern wanted to question them harder. Ask about the Apex Lances. Get an answer to what surely could not be true. Were these two somehow working with the aliens? And if so, for God's sake, why? But that was all secondary. First, she was going to bring these two in and scuttle their frigate before the fleet orbiting Earless discovered their presence.
I can destroy you at any time, Tolvern said. You know this, don't you?
Can you? Megat said. What is stopping you, then?
His arrogant tone suggested that either he didn't care, a distinct possibility given his reckless behavior in the mutiny, or he knew there were Apex forces in the system and Tolvern wouldn't risk shooting. Again, how would he know?
Right now you're only guilty of stealing an away pod. You know you can't outrun us. Surrender your ship and I'll give it back to you after we ask you a few questions.
You can't take us, Dijkstra said.
He wobbled, and Megat's hand shot out to steady him.
It's too late for that.
A ghastly grin spread across his face.
Only a miracle would do at this point.
What do you mean by that? Does this have something to do with the buzzards?
The two men cut the transmission.
Strange, Tolvern said.
Aye, bloody strange, Cap said. Something ain't right with that Dutch bloke.
Did it seem like maybe Dijkstra was trying to send us a message? Smythe asked.
If I didn't know better, Tolvern said, I'd think he was Megat's prisoner. But he's the only one who could have had contact with the alien fleet, and he must have let Megat out of detention. Did we ever find out who's in charge down in the gunnery while Barker is down?
It's Carvalho, Cap said.
Wonderful. We really are short-handed.
He's willing to take a shot with the deck gun, but he says we'll be exposed for a few minutes. Oh, and there's a good chance we'll destroy the ship anyway.
I've got a better idea. There are only two men, and one looks like he's dying of the plague. Tell Carvalho to prepare a boarding rocket. No, make it two. Probably overkill, but we don't want any surprises.
They still had a few hours until they closed distance with their prey. Tolvern organized the bridge, checked in on her crew in the sickbay, then went down to the mess to get something to eat. Maybe that would settle her stomach. Word came through that continued passive scanning had confirmed that it was a harvester ship around Erlis. The other ships were lances and spears. Tolvern thought about Moe's Driz. If he'd picked up the three sloops of war... their commanders might have already told him about the harvester ship in the next system. Tolvern could go back to Getsus, pick up the general and his sloops, and come back here to lead an attack on the harvester ship, see if they could break the blockade around the stricken planet. The odds would be desperate, but not impossible. But first she had to get her hands on the fugitives. Cap called from the bridge as Tolvern was finishing a bowl of stew and a thick slice of bread. Even as Tolvern took the call, alarms blared over the general channel, all hands at their stations. Tolvern suspected the worst, and Cap confirmed it.
Captain, it's the buzzards! They ambushed us!
Chapter 11 Carvalho was in the engineering bay with two assault teams, preparing to launch boarding rockets to seize Morpho. Four women and eight men, counting himself. Several were former Royal Marines who'd transferred to the Navy during the Civil War, when everything had been in chaos. They were strong and clever and good fighters, but there was a laziness to their posture that he didn't like. The worst was a man named Boyle, who was a big fellow, taller than Carvalho, and even more muscular. He stood with his jumpsuit hanging around his waist, and was messing around with a long non-standard knife. Next to him was a rat-faced woman named Boykin, who had scoffed when Carvalho asked the crew to show their ammo, and scoffed again when he ordered her to get another box of cartridges.
"I ain't gonna need more than two bullets," she said. "One for the Chinese and one for the Dutchman. Bam, bam, it's over."
Boyle and Boykin sounded like a comedy act in the port of San Pablo, the kind that told raunchy jokes and brought nude dancers onto the stage to wolf whistles and crude gestures. At one time, Carvalho would have been one of the lazy ones, mocking whoever was trying to get him to behave. Not anymore. The world was divided into scolders and scoldees, and curse it, he'd been promoted to the ranks of scolders. He cleared his throat, trying to think of words that would inspire confidence and keep them on their toes.
"We do not know what we are going to face in there," he began.
Boyle grinned.
"Two old men probably jerking each other off."
Boykin brayed. Carvalho tried not to laugh himself. He had a soft spot for this sort, there was no question. This would be easier if he hadn't spent so much time drinking with these people in the mess. He forced a growl into his voice.
"Now listen to me. I do not intend to die because we swagger in expecting a couple of old men to throw themselves at our feet. There is a reason the captain ordered 2 boarding rockets instead of 1. If she is sending 12 people, there is a chance 12 people will be needed.
Carvalho held up his hand to stop the objection, though at this point it was really just incredulous looks all around, rather than outright scoffing.
I know it may be very simple after all, but we must be prepared. At the very least, we must take them alive, not kill them. That is the hard part, no?
They looked more serious at this. It was one thing to blast your way into another ship, especially when the crew numbered all of 2 people, but another to take control without inflicting casualties.
Here is how we will mount our attack.
He took a small computer out of his hip pocket and brought up a representation of Morpho.
Boykin will lead the first rocket here. It's going to lodge itself near the bridge, where she is going to bang around making a lot of noise. That is all.
Boykin peered at him with that rodent-like gaze.
What do you mean, bang around? You aiming to keep me out of the action?
No, Boykin, I am holding you in reserve. You will draw the attention of our quarry to the bridge. Meanwhile, Boyle will thrust into the loading bay, then come in at your ear.
Yeah, Boykin,
Boyle said with a snorting laugh.
I'm coming in through your rear, and thrusting, Boykin, you hear that? Thrusting.
Don't meow me, you idiot, she punched his shoulder. You can thrust yourself up the arse.
Everyone was laughing now, except for Carvalho. He cleared his throat in a simulation of anger. It was really to keep himself from joining the laughter. It was a good thing Cap wasn't here. One wink or raised eyebrow in his direction and he'd have lost it. This was really hard, this leadership nonsense. The sooner the chief came back from the sickbay, the better.
Now I am angry, he said. The next person who makes a joke will be left behind. I'm very serious.
Of course you are, Carvalho,
someone else said. He said it with a solemn tone that may or may not have been ironic. Suppressed smirks all around. That was Oglethorpe, another crew member who'd served under Drake. He'd been in special forces before suffering a bad shoulder injury, and was still plenty big and intimidating. Carvalho scowled at him.
You want to take over here? Go right ahead. I'm happy to step aside.
Oglethorpe looked sheepish.
Sorry, mate.
Carvalho laid out the rest of his plan for taking Morpho without killing or getting killed. After the initial screwing around, the others began to settle down and listen. By the time he was finished, they were all business. Well, almost all. Boykin whispered in Boyle's ear. He gave her a mock serious elbow to the ribs. Carvalho let it pass.
All right, everyone, grab your gear. Time to load the boarding rockets.
He was checking his gun when Cap's excited voice came over the comlink.
Carvalho, you there? We're getting boarded. King's balls, they're here. Look out!
Huh? What? They were getting boarded? Voices cried across the open channel, and he tried to get Cap back on to make sense of it all. But suddenly the line went dead. What the devil? The comm was out entirely. That had never happened before. The ship shuddered. He fell to the ground, tumbling among the others from the assault teams, and when he lifted himself, he felt strangely light. He reached for his gun, which had clattered to the floor, and it almost floated up to his hand.
The gravity is failing,
Boyle said.
We must have lost the stabilizers.
Another man shouted.
Activate your mag boots!
No, that wasn't right. The gravity wasn't failing. It had stopped at roughly half strength. How strange. Half gravity. That rang a bell somewhere. But the ship shuddered before he could figure it out. Then a banging sound, followed by a screech. It sounded like a giant nail being driven through sheet metal. That noise was both familiar and easy to identify, the sound of a boarding rocket breaking through decks. The inner wall of the engineering bay ruptured, and a long torpedo-like tube burst in. It slid across the floor and came to a rest in the middle. A second torpedo slammed through the hull about 30 feet away, on the side of the engineering bay nearest the armory.
"Take cover!"
Carvalho shouted. He grabbed his weapon and sprinted across the floor in huge strides, like a leaping ballet dancer. The partial gravity made him feel like he could touch the ceiling 30 feet up. He slid behind several pallets loaded with supplies sent over from Dreadnought. Several others dove in next to him, including Boyle and Boykin. He waved others to take position behind a nearby forklift, and they moved swiftly to comply. Nobody was screwing around now, that was for sure. Carvalho and his team had weighed themselves down with gear for the assault, and even before they hit the ground, men and women were shuffling out of pressure suits and heavy mag boots, shedding cumbersome gear so as to better fight. Carvalho poked his head out just as hatches opened on both of the entry craft. Giant birds spilled out, one after another, more and more and more. It was like the world's biggest crates of turkeys, the birds packed together in confines so tight, no human would have tolerated it. Except that these turkeys were about 6 feet tall and laden with weapons of various kinds, these being hooked by hoses and other strange controls to beaks and wingtips. Some of the birds strode ostrich-like across the floor, while others launched themselves into the sky and took flight with huge wings. Carvalho took aim at some of the flying aliens and squeezed off bursts. Birds crashed to the ground under his gunfire, screaming in death. Others, merely wounded, fell, flapping and squawking, and the ones they landed on hurled them away, as if they were nothing but debris. Any thought that Apex might use some exotic energy weapon in close-quarters fighting vanished, as bullets came flying back from beak-operated guns. Carvalho ducked behind the crates to reload. Other defenders kept shooting. Several other crew members had been working in the engineering bay while the assault teams prepared, and while most of them had successfully taken cover, a handful were caught in the open. The drones pounced on one man, who disappeared beneath flapping wings. Other birds seized two more in their talons, a human and a Hrum, and pecked viciously at them.
"Captain," Carvalho said through the comlink, "are you there?"
No answer.
"Cap!"
He tried the general channel.
"Someone help me! We're getting mobbed down here!"
He rose and fired. The first birds out of the torpedo had been a uniform gray, but others came out after them, these ones with red and green feathers among the gray. Another was almost entirely colored feathers, a brilliant mix of blue, yellow, and red. The gray birds tossed the battered, bloody captives toward this one, where more gray birds held them down with their talons. The one with the bright plumage bent to the human first, head bobbing. The man screamed in pain. The bird came up with an eyeball and a chunk of the man's face in its beak. It tossed its head back and swallowed the grisly prize. That must be the leader. Carvalho aimed his gun at it and emptied his magazine on full auto. More birds went down, but there were so many, some still pouring out, that he couldn't even see if he'd hit his target. A bomb exploded against the crates. Flour and pulverized beans rained down on his head, together with something sticky that smelled like grape jelly. The boxes of food and other supplies were disintegrating under fire. The forklift next to them would provide better cover, but it was badly positioned. He grabbed Boyle and Boykin, and the three of them shoved at the vehicle to move it. Even at half gravity, it resisted their efforts. The brakes locked in place, and they had to tip it over first to get it to move. Birds swooped down from above, but gunfire drove them back. Bullets kept pinging all around. Screams came from Carvalho's right, where the buzzards had overwhelmed one of the other defensive positions. Men and women disappeared beneath a flurry of wings. Someone in the pile detonated a grenade, and broken wings and human arms went flying. The birds flew off with two screaming victims in their talons. Carvalho and his companions tried to bring them down, but failed.
"Look out!"
Boykin shouted. She dropped her empty rifle and whipped out a pistol. She fired twice into the sky, hit the bird swooping in at their heads, and sent it tumbling to the floor, squawking in rage and pain. A man to Carvalho's right cried for help as birds dragged him away. It was Boyle, Boykin's confederate, in low humor. He wasn't looking so funny anymore, writhing in terror, trying to stab one of his captors and free himself. One of the brighter colored birds flew in and dipped her beak. Boyle screamed. The bird came up with a huge chunk of flesh. Boykin had dropped to a knee to reload her rifle, and now she shoved a grenade at Carvalho.
"Take this!"
Carvalho pulled the pin, stepped into the chaos, and hurled it toward the enemy. A bullet zipped by his head. The grenade bounced into the middle of the birds now tearing at Boyle and detonated. It left another mass of feathers and body parts. The place smelled like a chicken slaughterhouse.
"Boyle!"
Boykin cried. She rose, her rifle reloaded, and emptied it into the enemy, screaming. More birds fell. In spite of their losses, it looked as though Blackbeard's crew was going to succeed in fighting off the enemy. Someone had been caught sitting on his hands to let Apex get so close they could launch a surprise boarding party. But Carvalho had been lucky to have a dozen armed men and women in the exact spot where the enemy pressed its attack. If he could hold the line for a few more minutes, other crew would join him in defending the ship.
"Captain," he tried again. "For God's sake, we need some help down here. Where are you?"
"Carvalho!"
Boykin screamed behind him. He turned as one of the buzzards landed on Boykin's shoulders and dragged her off the ground. Carvalho hadn't yet reloaded after throwing the grenade, and instead of shooting, he dropped his gun, jumped, and grabbed one of the bird's legs as it swept overhead. It faltered, struggling to stay aloft, as not one but two humans weighed it down. Feet dragging, still holding on with one hand, Carvalho reached for his sidearm. He found his knife instead. He slid it from its sheath and dragged it across the bird's leg. The bird screamed and tried to shake him loose. Boykin was still thrashing in its talons, and the three of them crashed to the ground, bird and humans all in a jumble. Gunfire churned through the buzzards. Someone was firing wildly at him, trying to save both Boykin and Carvalho from the same fate that had taken several other crew members already. Carvalho had no intention of being eaten alive or dragged back as a captive, but he didn't want to be shot by his own side either. He found where the bird's wing met its body and hacked with his knife while it tried to fight free. Its beak turned to get at him, but he ducked aside. It released Boykin, then tried to shake her loose as she wrapped her arms around its legs to keep its talons out of the fight. While she held it, Carvalho kept stabbing. Soon, it was dead in a mass of blood and feathers. Carvalho smelled like guts and offal and some sort of nasty bile-like substance that it had spit up when it died, thrashing beneath his blade. Boykin cried another warning. Carvalho looked up to see the brightly colored one stalking toward him, neck bobbing. He grabbed for his pistol and realized why he couldn't find it earlier. He'd given it to someone else early in the fight. He braced himself, knife in hand.
"You dumb bird, you will never take me alive."
It leaned its head back and Carvalho rolled to the side as it darted forward with its beak. He thought it was going to tear at him, but instead it spat a thick yellow gunk like snot mixed with egg yolk. He was moving and the substance flew past his ear and missed. Carvalho leaped at the bird, but it flapped into the sky as he stabbed, and his knife hit nothing but feathers. It flew back to rejoin its flock. The aliens were falling back. Gunfire continued, and other crew had begun to arrive at last. The newcomers and holdouts joined forces to drive the enemy back. The aliens piled into the torpedo-like boarding rockets, and suddenly they were withdrawing from the engineering bay, yanked back, as if on a line. 15 or 20 of the gray-feathered aliens stayed behind and kept shooting to guard the retreat. Bomb-proof shut behind the departing tubes, sealing off the outer hull. The instant that happened, full gravity returned. So many of the buzzards had stayed behind that Carvalho thought the battle would rage on for some time. But they slumped under the increased gravity, and the departure of the rest of their army seemed to leave them dispirited and disorganized. They fired back in a desultory manner, but the fight quickly turned into a massacre. Soon, the battle was over. They'd driven off the Apex attackers. Men, women, and Froom let out a ragged shout. It was more relief than triumph.
"Thanks a lot, Carvalho,"
Boykin said in an accusing tone behind him. He turned to see her face covered in the gummy yellow substance spit up by the bird. She must have taken the shot meant for him.
"Are you okay?" he asked. "It isn't poison, is it?"
"Don't seem so, but it's bloody disgusting, whatever it is. Like a camel spitting up on me, that's what it was. Should have hit you, not me."
How strange. A life and death struggle, and Carvalho had driven the bird off, but not before. What? It hurled its snot at him to show its anger?
"Dumb buzzards," he said.
He stripped off his shirt to wipe the stuff from Boykin's face, but shortly turned his attention to helping the wounded. Chapter 12. The lance had appeared from nowhere, snared Blackbeard, and sent in a boarding party. From the engineering bay came the frantic chatter of battle. The enemy ship had come in so close that it was literally brushing against Blackbeard's side. Tolvern kept Smythe at his console to manipulate the engines and Nib Pym in the pilot's chair to try to fight clear, but ordered the rest of the officers on the bridge to join the crew arming themselves to repel the boarders. Men and women stumbled from sleep all across the ship, rushed out from the mess, or dragged themselves from the sick bay. Tolvern joined them in the hallways, where Cap organized the crew, positioning some at key intersections, to delay the buzzards should they break through. The rest charged toward the engineering bay. Tolvern had almost reached the bay when Carvalho shouted on her comm.
"It's over! They're fleeing!"
She grabbed Lomelie.
"Quick, back to the bridge!"
The young woman had been following her, anxiously turning an assault rifle over in her hands. An expert with weapons at a distance, the thought of personally firing a gun had seemed to terrify her. Tolvern had ordered all manner of crew down to the engineering bay, but now realized she'd made a mistake with Lomelie. She should have kept the young woman at the defense-grade computer, in case it was possible to shake free long enough to get off a shot. And now the Apex ship was getting away. By the time Tolvern and Lomelie reached the bridge, the lance had accelerated away, and now jumped clear and vanished entirely. Tolvern cursed herself. The entire battle had only lasted about 10 minutes before Apex turned and fled. Had she panicked? But as she left the bridge yet again and made her way to the engineering bay to see the aftermath of the battle, she had a chance to reconsider. In close quarters combat, there was a fine line between victory and a total rout. She'd been right to throw everything she had at repelling the boarders. The lance had escaped, but so had Blackbeard. The engineering bay was a disaster. A 10-foot hole tore through the hull, and while they'd managed to close the bomb proofs and seal themselves from the vacuum, the bay doors were wrecked. She could see at a glance that they'd have to be cut off from the exterior and replaced. The floor was a mass of wings and feathers, and birds with broken necks. Two techs wearing full hazard suits, including masks, collected the alien bodies, while two other suited-up crew piled up the discarded alien weapons. Someone else sprayed them down with disinfectant. An astringent smell scratched at Tolvern's throat, mingling with the stench of offal and burned feathers. Carvalho stood above several human bodies and one room that had been carried away from the dead buzzards. The dead were unidentifiable, faces torn off, bellies opened and guts ripped out. They were damp with blood and chemical disinfectant. Tolvern took a deep breath to steady her churning stomach and looked away until she had it under control.
"Impressive work," Tolvern told Carvalho. 10-1, their dead have roused.
"There is no consolation for these ones."
He gestured at his fallen comrades with a look of helpless frustration.
"But you fought them in hand-to-hand combat and gave them a good thrashing. That will make them think twice the next time they're tempted to board one of our ships."
"How did this happen?" Carvalho asked. "Nobody saw them coming."
"All sorts of luck, good and bad. The jump hit us harder than usual. That's the bad. Smythe suffered a concussion and didn't search the area as well as he should have. We set off for Morpho without ever really looking. The buzzards must have been lurking nearby."
"Good thing they did not simply shoot us, yes?"
"Right, that's the good luck part. They were bent on taking prisoners, not destroying the ship. Did the enemy take any prisoners?"
Carvalho's face darkened.
3 crew are unaccounted for among the living and dead."
Tolvern forced herself not to think about what horrible fate might await them. She let out her breath.
"Bloody awful for them. But the rest of us are fortunate, that's what they were after."
She glanced at the growing pile of Apex dead.
"And that they were willing to pay dearly for their prisoners."
"Yes, we were fortunate,"
Carvalho said, though his tone said otherwise.
"If we hadn't been down here and armed, they'd have the ship by now. What about Morpho? Are we still going after it?"
"First things first. Let's get this cleaned up. Then we'll go after the fugitives."
"Half of my boarding party is dead or missing. They will need to be replaced."
"We'll find you a team, even if I have to go myself," Tolvern said.
She glanced around. The wounded had been carted off, but one woman sat by herself, her back to the wall, rubbing at her face with a damp towel. She had no apparent injuries, but her face was grey, and perspiration beaded on her forehead.
Is that Boykin? What's wrong with her?
One of the buzzards spit on her, Carvalho said. She got some in her mouth, and it seems to have made her ill.
Send her to the sick bay.
He gave Tolvern a funny look.
Doc is overwhelmed with patients, and the sick bay is not so well organized as I would like it. I would rather not have Boykin mingling with the other patients.
Suddenly she understood better how Carvalho had organized the cleanup efforts. The chemical disinfectants, the crew gathering the bodies. He was afraid of contamination. Of course he was. Why was Boykin sick after being spit on? That pale look reminded her of Dijkstra. Could he too have come into physical contact with Apex?
You've done well here, she said.
It is what the chief would have ordered if you weren't down with the trips.
But Barker isn't here, and you're on top of it. I'd say you're up for a medal.
Carvalho looked pained rather than pleased.
This is all your fault, Captain.
Tolvern laughed.
What's my fault? I just gave you a compliment.
You have made me responsible, and I do not like it.
He shot her an accusing look.
You know what I mean. I do not want to be ordering people about. That is not my way.
All right, Carvalho, I was going to promote you to security chief. But I'll see that you're put on septic duty instead, and I'll assign someone to shadow you to make sure you don't start up your illegal distillery operation again. Is that what you would like?
Yes, thank you, that would be a relief.
Carvalho looked around and sighed.
I suppose I had better finish cleaning up here first. None of these pendejos are up to the task.
A commotion near the breach in the engineering bay wall caught their attention. Some crew had gone into the wall to check on damage, and now they came scrambling out, crying out in alarm. Something shrieked its rage behind the wall. Carvalho rushed off, shouting at people to follow him. They soon dragged the buzzard into the engineering bay. It had several dozen red and yellow feathers on its breast, and Tolvern's hopes took a leap. Not only did she have her first prisoner, but it was from one of the higher castes. It must have crawled into the gap in the walls to hide during the aftermath of the battle, while the drones were dying to enable the retreat. The bird appeared uninjured, but couldn't get airborne in the heavier gravity. Men and women encircled it, trying to get in close enough to subdue it. It hissed and screeched and slashed with beak and talons. Someone tried to toss a rope over its head and suffered a nasty gash across the arm as a reward. The woman fell back with a cry, holding her bleeding arm. Other humans waved guns.
"Don't injure it!" Tolvern shouted. "We need that prisoner!"
Someone made a feint, and the bird whipped around to confront him. While it was still distracted, someone else charged in and tackled it, and then the humans mobbed it as it hit the floor. Soon they had its wings pinned, its talons bound, and its head pressed against the floor, while someone taped its beak shut. It screamed and thrashed through all of this, but the higher gravity seemed to leave it quickly exhausted. Once it was fully bound, it lay on the ground without struggling, only the occasional twitch of the eye showing it was still alive. Tolvern watched with satisfaction. She turned to Carvalho.
Put the bird in a detention cell and post a guard, someone who hasn't come into physical contact with the buzzards, if you can find one. Now I've got a better idea. Put it in stasis. We'll wake it up when we have the facilities to study it better.
The hell with that. I'm going to break its neck and we will eat roast buzzard for supper.
Carvalho.
Why not? That is what Apex will do to us, no? I bet it tastes like chicken.
His old insubordinate attitude seemed to have returned for better or worse. Tolvern ignored it, knowing he'd do what she commanded.
As for Boykin, she said, I don't want her anywhere near the prisoner. Have her decontaminated, then confine her to quarters. Keep her on full quarantine until we know more.
And if something unnatural happens, what will we do, dissect her brain?
I don't know, Carvalho. I'll make that decision when the time comes.
What about the dead buzzards?
Tolvern looked around the engineering bay.
We've already got all the specimens to study that we'll ever need. This stuff is just rubbish. Dump it in the incinerator, where it belongs.
Tolvern returned to her post, thinking about what she'd ask Dijkstra and Megat when she got them in custody. Better keep them quarantined, too. And maybe she'd bring Brockett to the interrogation, get the opinion of the science officer if there was something strange going on. The doc, too, when he'd finished treating patients. Her instincts warned her something was wrong as soon as she stepped onto the bridge. Cap was tense, Nib Pim was busy with the nav computer, and Smythe was hunched over his console muttering to himself. Lomeli stood by his side and looked just as agitated. "What are we looking at?" Tolvern asked, settling into her chair. The view screen didn't show anything.
"Have they jumped back in again?"
"The Ipex Lance is gone, if that's what you mean," Cap said. "We bloodied them good, and it seems they've had enough. It's these other buzzards we've got to worry about."
Cap manipulated the view screen. Two of the hunter-killer packs in orbit around Erlis had broken away from the enemy fleet. Had they been altered by the Lance that tried to board Blackbeard, or had they spotted the fighting from a distance? Either way, the aliens were now racing out from the planet. Tolvern was not alarmed.
"They must be 2 days' flight from our position. We'll grab our quarry and jump out of here long before the buzzards reach us."
"Aye, that's what I thought at first. Show us, Smythe."
The view screen changed to show a stylized map of the system, with the planets in orbit, the jump points noted, Blackbeard marked in blue, and the last known position of the Apex Lance in red. The approaching hunter-killers were also marked in red. Blackbeard had changed its course and was now headed on an intercept path with the incoming hunter-killers.
"Wait, why did we..."
Before Tolvern could complete that thought, she saw the yellow spot that indicated Morpho's position. The fugitives had veered their ship inward and were running toward the hunter-killers. Blackbeard had given chase.
"They changed course during the battle," Nib Pim said. "I turned to follow as soon as we broke free from the enemy. Was that a mistake, sir?"
"You did the right thing. If you hadn't, we'd be a couple of hours farther away from Morpho by now. Still, it looks like we can catch them long before the enemy arrives."
"True," Smythe said. "But look where we are when we do."
The tech officer shifted the view screen forward several hours, simulating the movement of planets and ships. At first glance, it still looked safe, but Smythe wasn't done.
"At which point, it's not like we can suddenly reverse our course. Nib Pim has us turning around here."
Smythe showed Blackbeard making a wide loop.
"At which point, the hunter-killers will be over here. Now check out where we are 5 hours after that."
Even before he shifted the view screen ahead several more hours, Tolvern saw the problem. They would still have a lead on the Apex warships, but the enemy would have closed within range of their short-range jump capability. And that meant Blackbeard would face battle against 8 lances before she got out of the system.
"What the devil is Morpho up to?" Tolvern asked.
"Air on the side of the buzzards," Cap said. "Far as I'm concerned, that settles it once and for all."
"I'm still not convinced. Apex sensors are poor, and at this distance they might not notice such a small ship. Especially not if they're looking hard for us. Megat would know this too."
There was something else that was bugging her.
"Those hunter-killer packs didn't set out from the planet until we were already boarded," Tolvern said. "They must not have seen us until it happened. Why didn't the attacking ship tell them? 2 factions again?"
"Could be that the Lance that boarded us was in the system observing the harvester ship," Smythe said. "They were close enough to spot us and tried to capture us on their own, looking for glory."
"Could be," she agreed.
It was only one explanation, but it answered a few questions, including one about the fugitive's behavior.
"So Megat has figured this out too. He's bluffing, taking us toward the enemy, figuring we'll turn tail and run. He'll then slip out of here before he's discovered."
"That's a bloody risk, though, isn't it?" Cap said. "Going to get themselves killed if they're wrong."
"If they'd continued on their previous course, we'd have captured them anyway," Tolvern said.
"Better us than the buzzards. They're working for Ipex, Captain. They've got to be."
"Either way, I'd love to ask those 2 some hard questions," Tolvern said.
"Ensign Lomeli, get me the gunnery.
I want a definitive answer if we can cripple Morpho from this distance."
Lomeli called down. To the relief of everyone on the bridge, Barker was back in the saddle, albeit unsteady with the reins after taking painkillers for the splitting jump concussion, and more curmudgeonly than ever.
"That's a negative, sir,"
Lomeli reported after the consultation.
"Barker said it's like shooting a mosquito. We probably won't hit it from this range, and if we do, there will be nothing left." "So it's a mosquito now, is it? Last time it was a sparrow."
Tolvern turned to Smythe.
"Are we cloaked?"
"Yes, sir, but as long as we keep on this course, Apex can hold us in their sights."
Then it's time to change course. Forget about Megat and Dijkstra. We're going to jump out of here.
Back to the Froome General, Captain? Cap asked.
No, Lieutenant. We're too far gone for that. And we need repairs more urgently than ever. Let the General do his business among the Froome. We're going to take this broken-down piece of junk to the yards and see if we can turn her into a Royal Navy warship. Pilot, chart us a course for Samborondone.
Chapter 13
Let me get this straight,
Captain Tolvern said a few days later as she walked across the sweltering tarmac.
The name of the planet is Samborondone. The name of the island is also Samborondone, and so is the name of the city.
Yes, that is right, Rodriguez said. The port, too.
So I've brought my ship to Samborondone port in Samborondone city, on Samborondone island, the planet of Samborondone.
Someone liked the name.
And I suppose the name of the system is also Samborondone?
Who has time for that? Rodriguez said. We just call it Sam.
It would have been funnier if he'd said it deadpan, but he couldn't resist a wink at Cap, who returned a toothy smile. Tolvern sighed, and Carvalho just shook his head. It was a reunion of old friends. Tolvern, Cap, and Carvalho, plus Hubert Rodriguez, their old friend from San Pablo, who now ran a shipyard on Samborondone. He'd grown a thick mustache, but he was just as slender as always, just as grease-stained. Blackbeard sat on the tarmac across from them, scarred and pitted. It looked remarkably similar to the last time they'd used Rodriguez's services. Since then, it had fought numerous battles, been battered, repaired, battered again, and patched up. This time was as bad as ever, and Tolvern sometimes had the impression that her ship was held together with band-aids on top of duct tape, all patched together with chewing gum and superglue. Hull integrity had been shaky enough to make Tolvern nervous about ordering the ship down through the thick cloud cover of Samborondone. Barker assured her that Blackbeard wasn't going to break apart in the atmosphere, but Jane offered worrying commentary whenever Tolvern queried the individual systems. Samborondone was a wet world, with only 10% of the surface landmass, and that broken into hundreds of islands, the largest of which was only 50,000 square miles or so. Nevertheless, between the gravity and the climate, it seemed like perfect Froome territory, which made it curious that many of the larger islands were unoccupied. Apparently a short but brutal ice age had buried many of them under expanding ice sheets and cooled others to the point where they'd been abandoned by the heat-loving Froome. The final blow came when the ice sheets melted completely and without warning, drowning other islands. All of this had happened hundreds of years before contact with Albion, so for once, human sugar and human warships could not be blamed for the collapse. There were still millions of Froome on the planet, but the Empress had designated three islands as human resettlement zones. Tens of thousands of Singaporean refugees had crowded into the existing Ladino ports and trading posts, and the economy seemed booming but tenuous.
I never thought I'd see you old pirates again, Rodriguez said.
Pirates? Tolvern said. We are no pirates, we're Royal Navy. Look at these uniforms. Even Carvalho is wearing the red and black.
You are somewhere between 8 and 20 jumps from Albion space, Rodriguez said, depending on whether you're being chased by angry Froome death cultists or slinking through undetected. You're as much a pirate out here as anyone.
Tolvern wiped the sweat from her brow. The weather's pretty much the same there. The Froome love their heat and humidity, don't they?
I'm bloody melting out here, Cap grumbled.
She'd finally got out of her cast and kept stretching and flexing her left arm as if it were a newly installed piece of equipment and she were learning its controls.
Do you think we could get off this blasted tarmac before my boots melt and my toenails catch fire?
Rodriguez gave Blackbeard an appraising look. A lorry had come out to haul the ship into the largest hangar, and was now fixing it with clamps and hooks. The yards weren't as well developed as his old place on San Pablo, but from the cranes and tractors busy on the far side, it seemed that he had a good start.
I assume we can trust each other at this point, he said. That I won't steal your ship and you won't steal my services.
As much as anyone can be trusted out here, Tolvern said.
And how about payment? Are you hauling silver?
No silver, Albion credit this time around.
Which might not be worth much if the buzzards eat your homeworld, he said.
At which point, silver won't do you much good either, will it?
Rodriguez gave a wry smile.
No, I don't suppose it would. If Albion falls, we're in trouble out here too. And that makes us all royalists, I suppose.
He nodded.
Credit works. You've got enough of it.
Assuming you'll charge me the same as last time.
Afraid the rates have gone up a bit, he said.
She grunted.
They weren't exactly bargain prices before.
You know how it goes. Labor is cheap enough. The Singaporeans work hard, and they're desperate for wages. But it's hard getting supplies this deep into Empire territory. What with the Hroom fighting Apex, fighting humans, fighting each other. And there's more demand for our services than ever.
Meaning pirates and smugglers always have money?
That they do.
Rodriguez gave an apologetic shrug that looked like it was concealing a delighted grin.
Anyway, I won't cheat you. Don't want to lose the Royal Navy's custom. Never know when one of your big ships will come wandering in needing a quick repair.
There will be a contract,
Tolvern said. It was not a question.
Of course, your obligations and mine spelled out in plain language.
Tolvern, Cap, and Carvalho fell in behind him as he led them toward his offices. They got a better view of the construction work going on at the yards. New pads, new warehouses and hangars. Plenty of people out working in spite of the heat.
You've certainly landed on your feet, Tolvern said. You must have come out of San Pablo with some coin.
I left just in time. It's all ruins now.
So much left unsaid in that simple exchange. Most of the coin, as she'd put it, had been from work Tolvern and Drake sent him to repair ships during Albion Civil War. Rodriguez should have given her a discount based on how much money she'd shoveled into his pockets already. On the other hand, Malthorn's forces had bombarded the Hroom continent with atomic weapons, which left the entire planet's economy in ruins, including the human settlements. Tolvern had been on the other side of the conflict with Malthorn, of course, but Royal Navy forces were still responsible for the devastation. She guessed she'd better pay the going rate. The yards were built on reclaimed territory from the high forests, as was the entire city of San Borondón. Looming mountain peaks encircled the city. Every time they cleared trees or graded land, they discovered ruined temples, baths, palaces, and other buildings from the long-vanished Hroom city, buried and preserved in mud from the periodic flooding. The trees here had massive trunks, with roots that dug hundreds of feet into the ground to keep from washing away when the waters rose.
I'm pretty sure this was a Hroom spaceyard at one point, Rodriguez said. The land is aligned too perfectly, and there aren't any of the temple complexes that we've uncovered elsewhere. There are so many shrines and temples everywhere else that I think San Borondón was a holy city for them.
A dark look came over Carvalho's face. He crossed himself and said something in Ladino, which brought a chuckle from Rodriguez.
Don't be so superstitious, my friend. What does it matter which god? If you had nearly been sacrificed to the god of death, you would not be so relaxed, Carvalho said.
Tolvern pointed at a tan stone spire that was obviously not human in origin.
What's that, then?
The building in question was about 100 feet tall. It had a bulbous, irregular look to it, like a child's sand tower at the beach, one handful of wet sand placed on top of the other and allowed dry.
That is also Hroom, but more modern. Never a temple, but some kind of living space. It's my office. You'll see why.
Rodriguez led them to the base of the tower, which looked out of place among the human-built tarmac, warehouses, control towers, and massive open hangars. The thing was eroded, ancient-looking, but utterly smooth on the exterior, with only 2 visible windows and no entrances other than the main one at the bottom, which was enclosed by a thick metal door that was obviously human in origin. It was blessedly cool inside, and the 3 Albion crew sighed in relief. Cap had unbuttoned her jacket on the tarmac and now flapped the sweat-soaked undershirt beneath, panting like a dog. A narrow spiral staircase climbed the tower, and they followed Rodriguez up. Rooms opened at every landing, with men and women working at computers inside. Cables and water pipes climbed and burrowed through the walls, looking ugly in contrast with the alien architecture of the building itself. "I don't see any air ducts," Tolvern said. "How do you keep it so cool?"
"That is not my work," Rodriguez said. "Whoever built this place knew what they were doing. It's insulated by the stone, and there's a water reservoir, a natural airflow that ejects waste heat through a funnel in the top. It's really quite ingenious."
The tower tapered gradually as it reached the top, and the final room was small in comparison with the ones below. This held a computer, a desk scattered with papers, and a window cut in the wall, which was still several feet thick, even at this height. The window bent to follow the curve of the wall.
"I regret installing this window every hot season, but it's great now."
"This is the cool season?"
Cap asked incredulously as Tolvern stepped up to take a look out the window.
"There are three seasons here, cool, hot, and rainy. This is the end of the cool and the start of the rainy season. Rainy is the worst. The toads have already started to come out."
Cap and Carvalho both asked about the toads at the same time, but Tolvern didn't hear the response, as she was too busy taking in the view. The mountains were immense, frowning from a great height, and white caps crowned the highest peaks. Given the heat, it seemed impossible that it could snow, even at the tops of the mountains. How high were those peaks, anyway? Muddy rivers and streams striated the green valley floor, and Samburondon was mostly built in the high ground along their banks. The forest was dense in some places, cleared for farming in others, and fresh, muddy gashes to the north of the spaceyard showed where both city and agriculture were spreading. It was more of an overgrown jungled town than a large city, but from the scattered room towers and the hill-like mounds that looked suspiciously like temples reclaimed by the jungle, it had apparently once been much larger. Given the age of the Hrum Empire, the wars internal and external, and the Ice Age that had wiped out civilization on the planet, Tolvern wouldn't be surprised if this valley had fallen into ruin several times, only to be rebuilt each time civilization staggered back to its feet. Was this the start of another rebuilding effort, or a false dawn ahead of a final collapse? The war with Apex would answer that question.
"Anyway," Rodriguez continued, "when it starts to rain, you get yourself inside right away."
Carvalho peered over Tolvern's shoulder.
"It's raining right now. Your people are not going inside. They are still working."
Rodriguez glanced out.
"This little drizzle? I'm talking about the real buckets. They call it a deluge."
"How heavy are we talking?" Carvalho asked.
"You'll know it when it comes. Did you see the funny-looking vehicles when you came in? No? We've got smaller ones that can handle a few feet of water, and the larger ones can go fully amphibious. There are times when the roads are so far underwater that you need a boat more than a truck. Anyway, I have a defense perimeter around the yard, which gives us a safety buffer."
"A defense perimeter against flooding?"
Tolvern asked, confused.
"Toads, Captain," Cap said. "Weren't you listening?"
Toads? That didn't sound very threatening. But after her experience on Hot Barca, Tolvern was hardly a skeptic when it came to hostile native wildlife. Giant turtles, crocodiles with horny beaks, mosquito-like creatures the size of sparrows. Whatever a toad was in this context, she was sure it wasn't a small brown amphibian you could hold in the palm of your hand. Rodriguez sat down at a computer terminal.
"I've got your damage report. You'll have my crew working full out, and it still looks like you're going to be stuck on Samburondon a while."
"I'll turn over my bursons and engineering crew," she said. "That should speed things up."
"A little," Rodriguez said. "Can't charge you any less, though. Your boys will be working for free if they do."
"They earn Navy wages, that's enough. Anyway, we've got other business on Samburondon,"
Tolvern added.
"Starting with a search for a pair of fugitives we think might be on their way here. I'm hoping you can help us find them."
She told him about Megat and Dijkstra, only hesitating before she shared her worry that the pair was working for Apex. There was no reason to keep it a secret, though, so she decided to explain it all, keep humans and Hrum alike looking for the fugitives. In the end, the only thing she concealed was the part that concerned the Sentinel battle station. Here she spoke in vague terms only.
"You really think they've turned?" Rodriguez asked.
"It must have happened to Dijkstra first, before we met him. He was already working for the Buzzards. Then, when we were distracted by the battle, Dijkstra told Megat some story about breaking free and making a run for it. Apex picked them up, did the same thing to Megat, and sent them on their way.
So let me get this straight. The birds have put something in their brains to control them?
Rodriguez looked skeptical.
How exactly?
Some sort of spit or snot.
He glanced at each one of them in turn.
You can't be serious. Mind control snot?
Our science officer calls it a brain-altering excretion, Tolvern said, and points to analogues in the animal kingdom. But yeah, mind control snot is more or less what we're talking about. It happened to one of our other crew, too, a gunnery assistant named Boykin, hit in the face while we were fighting off an Apex boarding party.
A buzzard sneezed on her?
More like spit, Carvalho said.
The bird was trying to hit me instead, but I ducked out of the way, and it struck Boykin in the face.
She took sick not long after that, Tolvern said. Pale, sweating, vomiting. Cried out in her sleep, and hit her head against the wall. She was calmer after that, and I thought she was getting better. When the doctor came in to examine her, she tried to convince him she was fine, but when I refused to release her from quarantine, she killed a guard and tried to fight her way to the bridge. Boykin was shot and killed before she could reach me, Tolvern continued. My science officer dissected her brain and found strange growths, like small tumors, and other areas that had atrophied.
Dios mío, Rodriguez said. It is bloody mind control snot, isn't it?
Cap nodded.
That's what we've been telling you all along.
Brockett thinks it's an outgrowth of the buzzard's natural flock-controlling mechanism, Tolvern said. They're like wasps or termites, with queens and warriors and so on. The higher castes control the lower ones with secretions, and they've adapted it to work in human brains.
Rodriguez listened to this with a look of horrified fascination.
The birds could do this to all of us, couldn't they? Turn us into zombies, make us their slaves.
I don't think that's their goal, Tolvern said. They breed their own slaves, an entire drone army of warriors and workers. The only use they have for us is to exterminate us to prove we are an inferior species.
Then why are they doing it?
Temporary spies, saboteurs and the like. So panic in the ranks. Maybe they just enjoy it, like they enjoy hunting and killing.
Cap spoke up.
But it don't seem like they got it perfect yet. The victims get all sick and sweaty, and it's obvious if you know what you're looking for.
Not yet, but they will, Tolvern said. I'll bet they infected the brains of the room long ago. It would explain how they penetrated so far into Empire territory with so little opposition.
They wouldn't need to do that, really, Rodriguez said. Only give the room sugar and they will do anything to get another fix of the drug.
If Megat and Dijkstra come to San Berendon, I want to know about it. We thought this was their most likely destination, and we're almost certainly ahead of them now.
I can help you there. By Hrum decree, human ships must land in one of three designated ports, and it will most likely be this one. This is the biggest, the most heavily armed, and with the best port facilities. Whether they're here to hide or to spread the mind control, whatever it is, I can find them.
They are flying a ship called Morpho. I'll have Smythe send you the specs.
Good.
Meanwhile, the three of us are heading into town to look for new crew, Tolvern said.
You'll find plenty of men and women willing to work. A lot of Singaporeans with spacefaring experience. It's where I get most of my own workers these days. I know a guy who can set you up, in fact.
Of course you do, Tolvern said. How much will it cost me?
Now my contact will pay the fee. He's legit. Well, as legit as they come around here. How many do you need?
I'm down 16.
Out of what, a crew of 89?
Rodriguez asked. Tolvern was surprised he remembered.
It's 94 these days. We took on 5 more to operate and maintain the belly guns you installed for us in San Pablo.
And you're short 16? Rodriguez asked. Mostly skilled workers, no? That might take a few days to find the right people.
The right people are the ones I already lost. I'd give anything to have them back, and not whatever substitutes you scrape out for me.
You are at war, Captain. Surely this is not a first for you.
Of course not, but she felt every loss keenly. 9 had died in the fight in the engineering bay. 2 more fell when the Apex boarding craft smashed through the hull, and 2 others had vanished, presumably hauled off by the buzzards to face torture and death. One other crew, a low-level gunner,
had died of the trips after that brutal jump. Finally, Boykin and the guard she'd murdered in her attempted escape. This was on top of the death she'd suffered at Sentinel 3, but she'd raided Commander Lee's crew to fill in the gaps. Now she'd be filling them in yet again.
"I have one other question before I start work," Rodriguez said. "You know me, Tolvern. I am no coward. I have lived for years among pirates and thieves and had more close brushes with death than I can count. I was on San Pablo when Lord Malthorn's forces attacked it with nuclear weapons, and I didn't run."
"What is your question?" she asked.
"What will you do if Apex tracks you to San Borondón?"
"Get into orbit as fast as I can. I'm not fighting them planet side, that's for sure. After that, if I have help and the odds are favorable, I fight."
"And if you don't like the odds?"
He studied her face, and she guessed this was not mere curiosity.
"Then we run like hell."
A brief nod.
"Good, then I have a final condition before I sign your contract."
"Yes?"
"If Apex comes, you will take me with you."
Chapter 14. Admiral Drake studied the woman sitting on the other side of the war room table as she worked her console. From this angle, Hillary Coe looked Ladino, with her black hair and the tint to her skin. But the impression vanished when she looked up, showing the unusual bone structure and that Chinese turn to her eyes and eyelids. Not pretty, really, but interesting to look at, as he'd found most of the Singaporeans. Commander Lee had made the same comment in reverse, although the Singaporeans' interest in the range of hair colors among the Albion crew was dwarfed by their fascination with the Hroom. The tall, long-limbed aliens were as exotic to the Singaporeans as animals at a zoo, something Drake found amusing. He'd been around Hroom all his life.
"This is your code, isn't it?"
Drake asked after Ko had studied the console for a few minutes.
"I won't deny it." "Who put you up to this?"
"Nobody."
Drake fixed her with a hard gaze, but didn't speak. Most people wilted under that stare, unable to leave the space silent, but Ko didn't respond. After a moment, she looked down at the console.
"You know it was wrong," he pressed. "That's why you kept your work hidden."
"Not at all. Otherwise I wouldn't have gone back in to fiddle with it. That's what tipped you off, isn't it?"
"What do you mean, fiddle?"
"I noticed a flaw in my code and fixed it. I saved an instruction by making this function recursive. It doesn't look like much, but that line executes about 1,500 times a second. I sped the whole thing up with that one tweak."
"Ko, I'm losing my patience. You'd better explain what this is about."
"It's exactly what it looks like. I'm not trying to hide anything."
"You inserted code into the defense grid computer. I don't care how many bloody times it executes. I care what it's doing. Ellison tells me you were siphoning off hundreds of gigabytes of data."
"Like I said, I wasn't trying to hide anything. If I had been, you'd have never known."
"If you're not hiding anything, then why won't you tell me exactly what you're up to? Why did you hack into a secure system? Why do you need all that data?"
"First of all, it's not remotely secure," Ko said. "You may think it is, but it's not. Smythe interfaced with the Sentinel computers and gave me all the protocols necessary to get into Blackbeard's defense grid computer. Once I knew that, it didn't take much guesswork to bluff my way past Dreadnought security. It operates on the same principles, no need to ask permission."
"You didn't ask anyone. You bluffed your way in." Drake nodded. "Right."
"Anyway,"
Ko said in a false patient voice, as if explaining something to a small child,
"I'm obviously collecting data so I can find out exactly how your systems work. You've got a lot of moving parts and I want to know how they interact. How do the batteries work together? How do you keep from knocking down your own ordnance with countermeasures? How do the Yood mines work? Why don't they target your own ships? That sort of thing."
"Why not ask?"
"I did. Manx told me it was none of my business."
"He did have instructions to keep you out of the system," Drake said, thinking. "Perhaps he was overzealous in obeying my orders."
"He wouldn't tell me anything. Why not?"
"Because you're not a Navy officer. You're an observer, brought along as a courtesy to Commander Lee."
"Who has promised to show you all of our weapon systems, right down to the Illuminon battery. Why does the sharing go in only one direction?"
"Because one of us still has a fleet, one of us still has a home world.
and one of us does not. Drake didn't say this aloud. For one, it was cruel to remind her that Apex was devouring the survivors on her planet. He'd nearly lost his own homeworld of Albion to a Hroom death fleet, trying to irradiate the planet as a sacrifice to their god of death, and the horror of such a fate was still fresh on his mind. It gave him sympathy for her loss. For another, Drake's fleet was ostensibly on a mission to destroy the Apex harvester ship and any other forces in orbit around Singapore. Once he'd freed Singapore, the two nations would theoretically be on equal footing. The reality, of course, was that the remnant population on the planet would be no assistance whatsoever in the war. Singapore's cities lay in ruins, the survivors reduced to subsistence levels, hiding in forests, deserts, and mountains, as the buzzards hunted them to extinction. Any value Singapore had was in Sentinel 3's weapon systems, and those of whatever other battle stations might still be hidden in the sector. Drake intended to take command of them, just as he hoped to direct any surviving Hroom fleets. Only Albion had the strength to take the fight to Apex, and if the others wanted to survive, they must join forces with the Royal Navy. And that meant join in a subservient position. There could only be one commanding officer. It couldn't be General Mose Driz, and it couldn't be Commander Lee. That left Admiral Drake. That was reality, not arrogance on Drake's part.
"I don't think you're working for the enemy," he began at last.
"Absolutely not."
"But I can't have you larding up our network with extraneous code either."
Irritation roughened the edges of Ko's voice.
"Now you're attacking my technical skills. The code is lean, and once I fix this function..."
"No, you won't fix it. Ellison is going to lock you out and reduce your clearance."
"What?"
Ko rose in a huff.
"That is not a challenge either. If I catch you trying to hack your way in again, I'll have you thrown in the brig."
Drake waited for her sputtered protests to die out.
"But I'll instruct Ellison to answer your questions. You can't dig into the code or mess around in the network, but you can see any high-level technical specifications that you'd like."
"Hmm." Ko settled back into her chair. "You could use my skills, you know."
"I'm sure I could. Will you take a loyalty oath?"
"What's that? Salute your lion flag and pledge fealty to King What's-His-Name?"
"Something along those lines, yes."
She shook her head.
"No, my loyalty is to my people, to the Singapore Imperium, and that will never change."
"Then you'll have to be satisfied with what I give you, for now. Later, maybe, we'll talk."
Drake stood, indicating that the meeting was over.
"I'm giving you a second chance, Ko. But I'm warning you, don't pull another stunt like this."
The fleet picked its way carefully through the Dragon Quadrant for the next 10 days, jumping 3 times on its way toward Singapore. They dropped probes, left a few Ute mines around jump points, and carefully scanned each system as they entered before barreling ahead. Drake's goal was to reach Singapore undamaged and undetected. He wanted one fight, and one fight only. Break the siege if he could, but if not, battle just hard enough to show Commander Lee that he was serious. Then return to the Sentinel base and get his hands on Lee's weapon systems. By then, he expected to be reunited with Tolvern and Mose Driz. From there, an aggressive charge at Apex at the head of a massive fleet that would hunt down the enemy and force a decisive naval battle. All was quiet until they jumped into what the charts called the Padang system. It was crowded with hundreds of ships, and it looked like Drake's fleet had stumbled into a killing field. Only gradually did the truth come out. It was a killing field, but not a recent one. The ships were derelicts, gutted and wrecked, flotsam. There were passenger ships, Singaporean war junks, cargo vessels, and destroyed Apex warships. The biggest clusters of wreckage hung around the jump points, but there was also a broad belt in an elliptical orbit that ran from the gas giants to the innermost world of the system.
"Someone had better clean this up,"
Drake noted as scans continued to add to the number of known wrecks.
"Or a star leviathan will discover this banquet and make the system impassable for 100 years.
Or maybe longer. A star leviathan would gobble up this debris, feeding on unexploded ordnance and fissile material, then, when sated, lay eggs. The hatchlings would menace the system for generations before they were ready to venture into the deep void.
On the other hand, Manx said, it should be easy enough to pick our way through this mess without being spotted. There's plenty of cover.
That was true, and Drake also took the opportunity to harpoon a wrecked war junk and haul it in. Ko protested, saying he had no right to strip Singaporean technology without permission, but he ignored her. The war junk had a curving hull, with wing-like protrusions that provided thrust and maneuverability, and even as a wreck, it was graceful in appearance, a thing of beauty. Drake was sorry to order the ship dismembered and hauled into Dreadnought for closer inspection. Later the next day, Ko joined the Admiral in Dreadnought's massive engineering bay, where they went over the pieces. She'd dropped her objections, and showed him the engines and weapon systems, explaining how they worked. The result was disappointing. There was an interesting pterillium compound in the ship's armor that he ordered sent to the lab, but no plasma ejector or Illuminon battery. Only standard lasers, missiles, and the like.
"This ship is from the First War," Ko explained as she ran her hand over the pitted hull of the war junk, now being cut into pieces by grunting, sweating Navy bosuns swarming over her surface like ants dismembering a dead lizard. "We hadn't developed our big weapons yet."
Not that those big weapons had stopped Apex in the end. Singapore had driven off the enemy, remained on full war footing for years, while the economy threw every possible resource at building a new fleet and the Sentinel battle stations, and yet the human civilization had been completely overthrown. But the Imperium had put up a good fight. Tech Officer Lloyd identified the wreckage of 14 war junks among the derelicts, plus numerous military support craft. And that was just the evidence of fighting in this system alone, and those ships that hadn't fallen into the sun or been atomized in a fiery explosion. When he was alone in his quarters, Drake worried. The more he learned about Singapore, the greater his estimation of their abilities. He'd initially assumed them small in numbers, like the New Dutch, or scattered into various colonies like the Ladinos. That was the impression given by the battered refugee fleet. Instead, he'd discovered the remnants of a unified nation that had marshaled its people, resources, and technological know-how, and still fallen. Was this to be Albion's fate, too? The warships were only one part of the debris in the Padang system. Most of the other wreckage apparently belonged to the hundreds of thousands of Singaporeans fleeing the planet. From the look of it, most of them had failed to escape. Drake's forces traversed half of the Padang system before the action found them. A refugee fleet had apparently been picking its way slowly across the system, drifting along with the wreckage as they eased closer to the jump point. Drake was going in the opposite direction, fully cloaked and quiet, and might have stumbled right past them without either side seeing the other. But someone had been stalking the refugees and now appeared. Back on the bridge, Drake stared at the view screen as the data came in. 4 hunter-killer packs, with a full allotment of spears and lances. They slipped in and out among the refugee fleet, picking casually, destroying some and boarding others.
15 hours until we cross paths, Manx said. The good news is that they haven't spotted us yet. The bad news is that there's no way to avoid them. We either move away from the orbiting debris and into the open, or we might stumble right through the fight.
Maybe it will be over by then,
Ellison said. Her words were hopeful, her tone less so.
Maybe, Drake said. But the buzzards look like they're playing around. They're in no rush.
Ellison glanced at Ko, who stood next to her at the communication station.
Then I assume we'll intervene?
Stay on task, Ensign, Drake told her.
Yes, sir.
She busied herself with something. As a communications officer, Ellison had had little to do while they were traveling in silence. Not only had she been unable to send subspace messages back to Fleet Headquarters, or to either Tolvern or Mos Driz, but Drake had choked off communication to the other ships in the fleet. The three other cruisers, Zealand, Formidable, and Repulse, stayed within a few dozen kilometers, and they often communicated via light signaling, a technology so old that it had been used by the ancient Greeks. As a result, Ellison had formed a friendship of sorts with Hilary Ko, who was teaching her how to interface with Singaporean vessels. Together with Tech Officers Throckmorton, Throck, and Lloyd, they were programming a translator that would allow English speakers to speak Chinese, just like the Singaporeans had done in reverse. One small problem, Navy crew would need a brain chip implant to interface with the communicator. So it was all hypothetical at the moment. Drake consulted with Lieutenant Manx.
I'm inclined to make a fight of it. Woodbury is itching to give his crew some experience. Repulse has never seen battle, and his crew is green. Captain Cates would be keen as well. She's always up for a fight.
I'm all for attacking, Manx said. We've been out here too long without a scrape, and I'm sure we can take them.
Manx was old Blackbeard crew, all the way back to when Drake's former ship was still known as Ajax. And if there was one thing the Blackbeard crew was known for, it was charging into the action.
But is this the battle we're looking for? Drake said. I love a lopsided fight, assuming we're not the ones getting lopped. But I need to make a demonstration for Commander Lee. Is this big enough?
We don't know how big it is, sir. Not until it's over. Are we sure these are the only ships in the system?
I've thought of that. These buzzards are in no hurry. They seem to have been waiting around for easy prey and found it. Could be two or three other enemy forces in the system, staying hidden until they're needed. But, Manx, we've got a fleet. Half the firepower of the Royal Navy is right here. We didn't come all this way to scout and reconnoiter. We came out to deliver pain to the enemy. And if my fleet isn't big enough to do it, nothing is.
Drake looked up as Hillary Coe made her way over. She was scowling, naturally.
Admiral Drake, she began, her tone peevish.
Now listen to me, he interrupted. Before you object and say I don't care about your people, why don't you wait to see what my decision is?
Her response wasn't what he'd been expecting.
You can't attack.
Drake blinked.
What?
I know, I feel the same way. There must be 10,000 or 15,000 people crammed into those ships. Singaporeans, my people. It makes me sick to think of what they're going through right now. They're terrified, and they're going to die. Some of them will be eaten alive.
And you don't want me to rescue them?
You can't fight this battle, Admiral. Not here, not now. We mix it up in Padang. We'll give away our location. The harvester ship at Singapore will be expecting our arrival. You'll risk the whole attack.
By the whole attack, you mean going through to your home system and assaulting the harvester ship in orbit around Singapore?
Exactly. You have to rescue the planet.
That's a fight I'm not ready to have.
Ko looked back and forth between the two men, her eyes bugging, a flush coming over her face, like a fast-arriving fever.
But you promised Commander Lee.
I didn't give a timetable, Ko, Drake said.
So you're going to dither around here while my people are slaughtered?
I'm not going to dither. I'm going to fight the enemy. I'm going to weaken his defenses of the approaches to your homeworld, so that when we come through with our entire force, there will be nothing to oppose us.
Drake shook his head.
But we won't be attacking the buzzards at Singapore until the General returns with his 30 sloops.
And HMS Blackbeard, Manx put in. And Peerless arrives with a task force.
Absolutely right, Drake said. I need all available forces.
That could be weeks. Millions will die before you liberate the planet.
Most likely. But if I move too soon, it will never be liberated. They'll all die.
Drake gestured at the viewscreen, which showed two lancers harpooning another refugee ship.
Meanwhile, there are thousands of people right here whose lives we can save.
Ko stared up at the viewscreen, her expression troubled. She didn't speak.
Then you're decided?
Manx asked.
Drake nodded. Warn the gunnery. Signal our forces. We are going into battle.
Chapter 15. Tolvern and Cap put on goggles and acoustic earmuffs before entering the foundry. Green fire blasted from nozzles at a square of Tyrillium armor being held in an oversized vise. It turned black as it absorbed the heat and hardened. Two men in heat suits dragged another plate of smoking armor on chains in front of water jets. The spray vaporized as it hit. The heat and humidity was suffocating, and acrid smoke bit the back of Tolvern's throat. The light was so intense on one side of the room that it was like staring into a small green sun. A man with a forklift hauled in more damaged Tyrillium plates to be treated with reagent and remolded. A woman, her face black with soot, gestured angrily for him to move out of the way so another forklift could get by with a load of finished armor. So many people working all at once, but it wasn't a very sophisticated operation, not compared to a Navy shipyard. This was all cobbled together parts, the plasma nozzles, obviously taken from a ship's engine and not engineered specifically for pterillium hardening. Five men were wrestling another piece of armor from a mold, a job that should have been done by Crane. "That's one of them," Tolvern said, yelling to be heard above the din. She pointed to the woman directing the forklifts. "The big Ladino with the missing fingers is the other." "These blokes look even busier than the last crop we tried," Cap said, also yelling. "With as much kine as they're pulling in, we'll be lucky if they don't steal our bosuns instead of the other way around." "These two are the last. I'll pay extra if I have to. You get the Ladino. I'll talk to the woman." Tolvern waved to get the woman's attention. Cap picked her way through the chaos to get to the man. Too hot inside to have a conversation, so Tolvern brought the pair outside. The factory sat on a narrow street, blending in with the other stone buildings that stood shoulder to shoulder. The roofs were made of heavy tiles, and the windows had bars over them with thick metal shutters to lock up. It gave the buildings a fortress-like appearance, but at the same time, there weren't the high fences topped with razor wire or iron spikes that were common in high-crime areas everywhere. But the strangest feature of this part of the city was how the roads were in troughs below the level of the buildings and looked almost like empty canals. Once you parked, you had to climb stairs to get out from the street level. The rain had picked up and was a steady drumbeat on the roofs. The clouds were so black overhead that it looked like evening, even though it was still the middle of the day.
"Don't like the looks of that," Cap said, peering skyward. "Maybe it's one of them deluges they told us about."
The woman they'd brought out of the factory stepped out from under the eaves, collected rain in her hands, and splashed her face. Soot still streaked her features when she was done, but she looked human now. Albionish, from the looks of her.
"It's safe enough, for now," she said. "I'd keep an eye on it, though. Looks threatening."
She glanced at the two newcomers and settled on Tolvern.
"You're the Navy captain Rodriguez told me about?"
Her English had broad vowels. Tolvern pegged her as a Mercian.
"Captain Tolvern, yes. HMS Blackbeard. I want to enlist you in the Royal Navy. I lost some of my best persons, and Rodriguez says you're good."
"Can you get me a pardon?"
"A what?"
"I'm already Royal Navy. Midshipman O'Keefe, HMS Lexington. That mean anything to you?"
"I see," Tolvern said.
"What's that then?" Cap asked.
"Lexington was one of Malthorn's destroyers," Tolvern explained. "She took damage in the Fantler system and disappeared. Where is Lexington now?"
"Lexington never made it," O'Keefe said. "My captain was Malthorn's cousin and figured he'd be hung if he returned. So we scuttled, sold the ship for parts. The crew went its own way. The Civil War's over, I hear. That about right?"
"And pardons issued," Tolvern said.
"What about for deserters? Because I figure that's what all of us from Lexington count for now. Isn't that right?"
"Was it your idea to desert, or your captain's?"
"None of the crew had much choice in the matter. We were all the way out here, and the ship was sold out from underneath us."
"Put it in writing, sign a loyalty oath, and I'll have you back at your old grade and pay. That's more than can be said for most of Malthorn's people."
"And your ship, it's Blackbeard, right? All shot up, is she?"
"We took a beating," Tolvern admitted. "More than one beating, in fact. We had hull integrity issues where we fought off a boarding party, and we're still running tests on all the systems that came down in the overhaul. But we're armed and armored, and with a couple more bosuns we'll have a full crew."
"How long have you been in the yards?"
2 weeks. We've been working full out, and nearly have her patched up. I'd love another week, but I'm not sure I can get it. I'm ready to ship out now."
O'Keefe studied her, as if wondering if Tolvern was understating Blackbeard's damage as a part of her pitch. She lifted her hand in a slow salute.
"Aye, Captain, then I'm on board."
Cap was still scowling.
"Just don't be carrying any of that Malthorn rubbish with you. We ain't that kind of ship. No cucumber sandwiches and posh talk, you hear?" "Look at me," O'Keefe said.
She was filthy, her hair hacked close to the scalp, so poorly it looked like she'd done it herself with a pair of old scissors and a cracked mirror.
You see anything posh here?
Glad you girls can kiss and make up,
the other person from the foundry said in a light Ladino accent. He'd been watching the exchange with a stony expression.
But I got a good job already. What's in it for me? Pays good out here for a man with my skills, and I have never been in your navy, so that crap won't work with me.
Tulvern suppressed her irritation. These two weren't her first choice, more like her tenth. Although, if she'd known O'Keefe's background, she'd have tried the woman earlier. Tulvern had been turned down plenty of times over the past week as she scratched together new crew. She'd even tried to hire some of Rodriguez's people on a contract basis, with a kickback going to the owner of the space yards. Rodriguez turned her down.
You must be Ortiz, Tulvern said.
When he nodded, she said,
How about a signing bonus of £50?
Cap's eyebrows shot up at this, but Ortiz looked unimpressed.
I can earn that in 6 weeks with overtime, not good enough.
Tulvern had been prepared to offer him £3 a week, which was what an experienced bosun earned, but if he was telling the truth about earning £50 in 6 weeks, she was nowhere close enough.
How much do you want? She asked cautiously.
More.
Tulvern turned to O'Keefe.
Is he good?
The midshipman shrugged.
Good enough. I'm better than you, Ortiz told O'Keefe. Not bloody likely, O'Keefe said. Burned your fingers off, didn't you?
£75 signing bonus, Tulvern said. £3.50 a week.
Ortiz shook his head.
Nah, still not worth it. King's balls, Cap said. £75 bloody pounds, don't be an ass, take it. I was thinking 200 bonus, £5 a week, Ortiz said.
You are mad, Tulvern said.
I can't offer that kind of money. It's already going to cause me trouble if the crew hears I'm waving around signing bonuses.
Ortiz shrugged.
Sorry.
You'd rather work here, sweltering? Tulvern asked. Messing around with substandard equipment?
And stay alive? Yeah. I know why you want me. It's because your other people died, didn't they? I don't figure to go out and get shot at by buzzards and human pirates. If I'd wanted that, I'd have joined up years ago. So you're a bloody coward, Cap said. Come on, Captain, let's leave this bloke. He ain't worth it anyhow.
The rain had continued to pick up while the four had been talking until it poured off the roofs of the surrounding buildings in sheets. From there, it drained into the sunken roadbed and joined a small but growing stream.
What do you think? O'Keefe asked Ortiz. Is it a deluge? Drains are backing up, he said. Roads will be rivers in a few minutes. Could be. I don't hear any thunder. Usually it slams into the mountains and all goes off at once. Usually, but not always, she said.
Lorries and private cars had been rolling by earlier in the conversation, but had largely vanished from the street. Heavy metal shutters slammed shut up and down the street, blocking windows.
Yeah, I'd say the toads are coming, O'Keefe added. Let's get inside.
She reached for the door, but it didn't budge. She cursed.
It's locked.
Cap clapped her hands sarcastically.
Well done, love. You must have been the pride of the Royal Navy. Someone must have locked it from the inside. Must not have seen us come out.
Cap didn't look convinced.
Better out them toads don't appear.
Ortiz pounded on the metal door, but nobody responded. Too much noise from the foundry, no doubt, plus the thundering rain on the roof. O'Keefe cursed again and said they'd have to go around the building to one of the loading bays. That would take them into the rain. A truck pulled up. It had big tires and was elevated to get it above the water. Metal spikes stuck out of the roof, the tire rims, the bumpers, and the hood, giving it a porcupine appearance. A window came down.
Captain!
It was Carvalho, back early from the yards. Tulvern had told him 2 hours. Give her a chance to seal the deal with drinks, pay off the foundry owner for stealing two of his employees mid-shift, and wrap up other business in town.
The fugitives are in San Barondon, Carvalho said. We found them.
Tulvern had nearly forgotten about Dijkstra and Magad. Blackbeard had been stripped down and rebuilt in the 2 weeks since she came into Rodriguez's yards, and Tulvern had been consumed with the numerous arguments, compromises, and simple logistics of the overhaul, as well as the struggle to acquire supplies and crew. Tulvern had spent a fortune in the end, but the result was that she was ready to ship out, whether she hired on the last two bosuns or not.
Why didn't you call?
Tolvern said. Get in, I'll tell you. Tolvern turned to O'Keefe. Find me in the yards when the storm is over. Ortiz, the offer stands.
He snorted.
Don't wait up on my account.
Have you bang your knob off next time, Cap muttered. Tolvern grabbed Cap and braced to make a dash through the rain to the truck. Before they could move, the ground rumbled, and water spouted from one of the overwhelmed drains about 30 feet in front of them. Tolvern stared through the sheet of water, thinking that something had blocked the drainage system and part of the street was about to collapse. Ortiz and O'Keefe pounded on the metal door to the foundry, screaming for someone to open up.
Run!
Carvalho yelled from the truck. There was panic in his voice. The two Blackbeard officers sprinted for the truck. The water hit like buckets in the face the instant they left the shelter of the eaves. So thick, Tolvern felt like she was drowning in it. The water was already up to her calves in the street, and the two women fought to get through it. The water kept spouting ahead of them, and paving stones spit into the air, splashing down in a cascade of mud and stone. Tolvern and Cap both got in the front, bringing so much water with them that Carvalho, sitting behind the wheel, held up an arm to block the spray. The back door opened and two people scrambled in, O'Keefe and Ortiz. Oglethorpe was already in the back of the truck and muttered a complaint as they shook off like a pair of wet dogs. The ground heaved in front of the truck, and a massive shape squirmed up through the mud and broken paving stones. Carvalho got them moving before Ortiz had even closed the door, and drove away in reverse before Tolvern could get a good look at whatever it was that had come out of the ground.
I didn't call because the comm system is offline, Carvalho explained as they rolled down streets that were as much canal now as road. So I had to come out and find you in person.
The comm is still down? Tolvern asked, frowning. I thought Smythe was going to have it up and running by midday. Rain thundered on the roof, and while the truck had plenty of clearance, it was slow going and pushing through all the water. They came upon what looked like a sinkhole, except it was rapidly filling with runoff. O'Keefe told them, in a tense voice, to turn around. That was no sinkhole, she said. It was where another toad had broken up through the roadbed.
Something to do with the network,
Carvalho said when Tolvern pressed him about the communication system.
We lost computers or something. I don't know what he's babbling about. You will have to talk to Smythe yourself. He wants to run diagnostics before we leave the planet.
Oglethorpe was messing around with weapons in the back, and Tolvern glanced back to see what he'd brought with him. He'd once been Special Forces, and still fought well, in spite of a messed-up shoulder. He'd hauled a small arsenal of rifles, shotguns, and hand cannons along, and she figured they might need them if any more toads popped out of the ground. Tell me about the fugitives, she said, turning back to Carvalho. Are they still holed up on their ship?
This has nothing to do with me, Ortiz said. I want to be let out. With toads coming out of the street?
O'Keefe said.
Come with us to the yards. They have a perimeter. You'll be safe until the deluge is over.
Fine, but only until the rain stops. I'm not joining your crew for 1,000 guineas.
Yeah, we get it. You're scared, Cap said.
That is right, Captain,
Carvalho said in answer to Tolvern's question.
They negotiated with the port authorities, landed in a field a few miles from the yards, and have been sitting there ever since. Nobody has talked to them. I figured it was better to come get you first.
Cap studied Carvalho.
Something's wrong, ain't it? I am fine. I can see it on your face, love, Cap said. Look at him, Captain, and tell me I'm wrong.
Carvalho's brow was furrowed, and he hunched over the wheel, and it wasn't just his posture. His voice was strained, with none of its usual swagger. The presence of giant killer amphibians in the streets might have explained it, but Tolvern had spent enough time with Carvalho in the swampland of Hot Barca to recognize something else was troubling him. He glanced over his shoulder, then looked at Tolvern.
Not sure you want it coming out in front of the new recruits. Not until you've got them settled.
I won't be put off, O'Keefe said. And Ortiz won't be put on, either. Whatever you got to say, you can say it in front of us.
Go ahead, Carvalho, Tolvern said.
It is the comm system. Smythe brought it up for a testing before he took it offline again. There was a subspace from Mos Driz. He mentioned his fleet and rendezvousing with Admiral Drake.
Cap groaned.
That dumb room? Why the devil would he do that? Doesn't he know better?
I don't understand, O'Keefe said. What's the matter with sending a subspace? It means the buzzards know where we are, Tolvern said. If the general sent it, Apex heard it. And that means they know we're on Samberondon.
Sounds like a lot of worry, O'Keefe said calmly. Maybe they weren't listening. Maybe they're four systems away.
You haven't faced the buzzards, Cap said, or I fancy you wouldn't be sitting back there all smug-like.
How long did you say until we leave? O'Keefe asked. A couple of days. Get into orbit, get cloaked. We'll be fine.
Tolvern shook her head. The sensors can't relay a time when they picked up the subspace, only that it arrived. You need the communication system for that. And it was offline for 6 days. Who knows when the general sent it, or when the buzzards heard? If he sent it 6 days ago, well, let's hope he didn't.
Chapter 16. Tolvern began to think the threat of toads was overhyped by the time they reached the outskirts of town. The rain lashed down, pounding on the roof and destroying visibility out the front. Thank God for the view screen, which used sensors to construct and display their surroundings. The water channeled into big canals that flanked the road, but by now they were overflowing, and an uprooted tree blocked their path where it had washed across. The truck was partially amphibious and could go through deep water, but it couldn't get past the tree. The six of them climbed out the windows and waded into water that was nearly waist-deep. Carvalho and Oglethorpe hooked up a winch to drag the tree out of the way, and the rest of them established a defense perimeter to watch for toads. Tolvern peered into the gloom, trying to see anything through the curtains of water and the churning, muddy canals. She had a rifle, but wondered if a life jacket might not be a more critical need as the current sucked at her legs and tried to yank her from her feet. Forget giant toads. The floodwater would drown them if they weren't careful. Cap shouted a warning. The canal erupted to their right. A huge, lumpy shape crawled onto the road, 10 feet tall and twice as wide as the truck. With a giant lumpy head that was half the size of the animal itself and two enormous bulbous eyes, it really did look like a giant toad, all except for the pig-like snout. Tolvern was standing closest and lifted her rifle as one eye swiveled toward her. The toad's mouth opened and a black tongue bunched at the back, ready to strike. She shot it in the mouth. Cap and Ortiz fired at the same moment, and O'Keefe opened up a split second later. Carvalho and Oglethorpe dropped the winch and fumbled with their weapons. The toad bellowed, a sound that was a cross between an enraged bull and a trumpeting elephant. It hopped backward and disappeared into the mud and water. She caught a glimpse of its lumpy back emerging from the water, aimed her rifle, and fired again before it was gone.
"Watch yourself," O'Keefe said. "We didn't hurt him. We only pissed him off. He'll be back."
"Stay on that winch," Tolvern told Carvalho and Oglethorpe.